Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. Our victim today is 24-year-old Alicia Hannan, who was last seen leaving a luxury hotel in South Miami Beach in the early morning of January 6, 2002. Alicia was from New Zealand and was well-traveled, frequently spending time in Miami with a man she was dating. But she was in the process of making some major changes in her life and went to Miami with plans to tie up some loose ends and then start over in New Zealand. Alicia left behind a 3-year-old son, Adrian, who grew up without his mom and deserves to know what happened to her. Today, I'm going to get the lowdown on Miami life from Sophia Wardell, co-host of the Travel Brats podcast. The Travel Brats podcast inspires wanderlust and fosters meaningful travel experiences for the energetic, adventurous traveler. With a mission to inspire, educate, and connect travelers worldwide, the Travel Brats have become a hub for like-minded individuals seeking authentic experiences, insider tips, and the most memorable adventures. Sophia and her co-host Natalie share their own experiences through their podcast and blog. Their vision for the Travel Brats extends beyond just a platform. It's a movement, a community of passionate travelers united by their love for adventure and their belief in the power of travel to inspire individuals, bridge cultures, and brighten lives. And it is one of my favorite podcasts. Sophia, thank you so much for joining me on the last trip. Let's chat about Miami. What's the history there? How has Cuba influenced Miami?
Cuba has had an extremely significant influence on Miami, particularly due to the waves of Cuban immigration to the city, especially after the Cuban Revolution in 1959. It shaped the city's identity, culture, economy, politics, in so many ways. To talk a little bit about each of the aspects, politics, Cuba had exiles and their descendants, which had been actively involved in local and state and national politics for years since they came over, shaping policies, perspectives on issues, especially issues related to Cuba and Latin America. A big part of that is when you're in Miami, you feel like you're in another country. You feel like you're in Cuba. When I moved to Miami, I didn't expect that. I didn't know anything about that. And so that was a bit of a culture shock for me, how much not only Latin American influence, but Cuban influence there is. The Cuban culture is in art. It's in the music. It's in the cuisine. It's in the language. So you've got like salsa music, mambo, Afro-Cuban rhythms that have totally blended into Miami's music scene. You have some clubs that are just only Latino, some that are specifically Cuban. And Cuban artists even have made the city vibrant and contributed to the colorful art that's there. It's kind of a signature of the city, that colorful popping art. The cuisine, it's all over Miami. The city's got numerous Cuban restaurants and they serve authentic Cuban foods. Some of the signature dishes would be the sandwiches, the picadillo, and the arroz con pollo, but it's just done very well. And architecture, huge Cuban influence. The heritage can be seen in much of Miami's architecture. They have a neighborhood called Little Havana that's colorful Art Deco buildings and that classic Spanish style architecture as well. In regard to language and demographics, Cuban Spanish is widely spoken in Miami, and that's a little different. You'll realize that the Spanish you learn in grade school is Spanish from Spain. And just like the United States has all these different lingos, whether you're from the Northwest or you're from California, or you're from the South or even Florida, Spanish has the same thing. Cuban Spanish is really interesting coming from a Mexican Spanish background for me. And then the economy, Cuban migration had a huge impact on the economy. And it contributed to growth of tourism, hospitality, international trade, especially, which we'll talk about, good trade and bad trade. And Cuban entrepreneurs have also established a ton of successful businesses in Miami, which played a huge part in enriching the city in terms of economic landscape and further diversity.
When I think of Miami, I think of drug trafficking, cocaine cowboys, the 70s and 80s. Did that have a big impact on Miami?
Yes, it did. The cocaine cowboys era and the drug trafficking had a huge impact on Miami during the 1970s and the 1980s. It caused a ton of drug-related violence, crime, corruption all over Miami. And it's because Miami was the major entry point for cocaine smuggling into the U.S. for drug cartels. So the big drug cartels, Colombia, Mexico, they came into the U.S. through Miami. The big one, for example, would be the Medellin cartel led by Pablo Escobar. This was an explosion of wealth in Miami from the drugs. And it was led by the cartel individuals, not only the leaders, but all of their people that were in on the lower levels, middle levels of the drug trade. It fueled construction and the huge construction boom because drug profits were laundered through real estate investments, which led to rapid development of luxury properties and businesses. However, it contributed to a culture of excess, which had conspicuous consumption and hedonism, and that just filled Miami and started a lot of the crime and the widespread violence. There were rival factions fighting for control of lucrative trade routes and markets. So this kind of tore the city apart. And law enforcement agencies really struggle to contain the violence as they do in those individual countries in Latin America, because with so much violence and they're so powerful that it is very hard to contain. There were high profile cases and efforts to crack down on the drug trafficking, but it created the entire cocaine cowboys era, which gave Miami its reputation as kind of a sin city marked by glamour and also danger, which still is around today.
I like the idea of glamour and danger. That's the world I want to live in. I've heard Miami is called the Magic City. How did that come about?
This is really interesting because this was prior to the whole drug entry into Miami. It was often referred to the Magic City, which is a coin termed by a local newspaper editor, Julia Tuttle. It developed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and she created the term to describe the transformation of Miami from this small, remote outpost city on the water in Florida that was kind of uncharted, and it transformed into a thriving metropolis overnight. It became something like you could compare it to back in the 20s when people were in New Orleans. It was the glitz and the glamour and the parties and the music. Julia Tuttle, she's quite interesting. She was a prominent Miami pioneer. She originally visited her parents in South Florida in 1875 and fell in love with Biscayne Bay, which is in Miami. And she later purchased 640 acres at the mouth of the Miami River and returned as a widow to live there in 1891. So she convinced Henry Flagler to bring his railroad down to the Miami River. And over 7 years that she lived there, she worked to build the community. And then in 1896, Miami was incorporated as an official city. And then from there, it experienced a significant boom in population, infrastructure, and the economy in the early 20th century, fueled largely by the Florida East Coast Railway and the construction of the Port of Miami and the influx of people drawn to the area, especially because of the warm climate and all the new business opportunities. The nickname still fits the city's vibrant atmosphere, the culture, and just the ongoing growth and innovation.
That is magical. What are some myths that people have about Miami or some misconceptions? Because I probably have a different idea of Miami than what it really is.
There are a lot, and some of them still hold a little truth. The first one that could be a big misconception is everyone in Miami is wealthy. And you see a lot of that in certain areas of the city. I saw that in Brickell and Key Biscayne. Those are two of the most wealthy areas in Miami. It's home to many affluent individuals and neighborhoods. It has significant socioeconomic diversity. Many residents are working or middle class, and they may not enjoy that lavish lifestyle that's often associated with Brickell and Key Biscayne. Those are the richer areas. You'll see celebrities or rich business tycoons that have homes on the water. You can see their places crossing the bridge to South Beach, which is pretty cool too. A lot of more poor downtown and Wynwood, or areas in downtown, because downtown can be nice and downtown can also be a little bit sketchy. And then parts of Wynwood would be some of the poor areas that you learn how to navigate around. But there's a huge mix of people in Miami because there's all sorts of jobs. So whether you are the CEO or you're working for the CEO or you're actually somebody that has a little bit lower of a pay grade, they all live in Miami. Another myth is Miami is only about beaches and nightlife, but it offers much more than that. It has a really rich culture and diverse neighborhoods. The food is incredible, and it doesn't just have Cuban food. It's got food from all over because it's one of the most diverse cities in the United States. And it has a thriving arts community. Every year they hold Art Basel, and just the art is really fun to see in Miami. You don't necessarily have to be a party animal to enjoy Miami. And all Miamians are Latino or Cuban is another huge misconception that people seem to think. And while Miami does have a large Hispanic population, they also have a melting pot of culture. Some people say Miami's not dangerous. Some people say Miami's so dangerous. And it can be dangerous, but not as dangerous as you may think. For example, if you were to look it up on the FBI's top 15 most dangerous cities list, it actually is not on the top 15, which was a surprise to me when I was doing the research for this, because I assumed that it would be lower, but it would still be on there. That list measures the violent crime rate and highest cost of crime per capita, which includes instances of murder, manslaughter, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. So like any major city, Miami has its share of crime, drugs, gambling, etc. But it's unfair to label the entire city unsafe. As with any city, you've got to exercise common sense, take precautions, and just do your research. Miami is all glitz and glamour is another one that a lot of people will say, and that's false. Miami does have a huge glitz and glamoury side, luxury hotels, high-end restaurants, designer boutiques. It also has a really laid-back, casual vibe in some of the cities. There are plenty of opportunities to enjoy the city without breaking the bank. You can explore parks, outdoor spaces, museums, even go to dining at local eateries. Food trucks there are amazing. There are also free cultural events like art festivals, and beaches can be free besides the parking, like Key Biscayne, South Beach, and Hollywood Beach. Another one is Miami is only for the young and single. And that's false. While Miami's known for vibrant nightlife, party scene, you know, you can meet some handsome strangers, it's also a great place to live for families, retirees, and people of all ages. It offers excellent schools, diverse neighborhoods, and plenty of activities for all people. And the last thing is a lot of people are terrified to drive in Miami. The traffic is too bad. There is a lot of honking and there is a lot of cutting people off, but it's not any worse than any other city. It just kind of depends on where you are and what time of day it is. I would avoid rush hour at all costs.
Interesting. I definitely thought some of those myths were true. And I'm over on the West Coast, so we have earthquakes over here, which you guys don't have in Florida, but you do have hurricanes. Have you ever been in a hurricane? What was that like?
Yeah, so I have not actually physically stayed down here because I'm not from Florida. So when a hurricane comes, I'm like, I'm leaving. So I drive home to Georgia, but I went through like my home and my stuff and my car and stuff have been through a couple. Irma was in 2017 and was supposed to hit at a Category 4. Everybody freaked out, 10-foot water surge, all that jazz, terrible. And it really wasn't that bad. There was some flooding, some debris, some destruction, but it really wasn't terrible. I remember coming back after it and helping out in just some of the neighborhoods that lost power, bringing food with some of the local churches and things like that. I think it hit at a Category 2. And Ian was the one that was just a monster. And it was in 2022. I remember the place where my husband and I actually got married was just totally destroyed. Sanibel, Captiva, Fort Myers Beach, downtown Fort Myers was where we got married. Naples and Bonita were just totally flooded. Fort Myers Beach was totally decimated. Sanibel, Captiva, the bridge broke. A lot of those places are still rebuilding. It was really sad. A lot of people died because in contrast to Irma, when everybody was freaking out about Irma and a lot of people didn't leave, they didn't think anything of Ian. And it actually changed course. It was supposed to go Tampa and then it made a last minute turn toward Fort Myers. So a lot of people were stuck down there because they didn't get out and there's really no place you can go.
If someone's visiting Miami and there's a hurricane coming and they decide to stay, what can they do to prepare for that? Or should they just leave? Should they cancel their flights?
That's a great question. The biggest thing to do is stay informed because local news, radio stations, weather apps, they'll all give updates on hurricane progress, categories, projected path, intensity, evacuation orders. Pay attention to these. A lot of people don't leave and they're in emergency evacuation areas. If you're in an emergency evacuation area and you're able to leave or drive away, do that. Just follow any instructions that you're given. Stock up on supplies. If you're a visitor and you can't leave and you're going to ride it out, gather essential supplies. Get toilet paper, paper towels, non-perishable food, water, medications, flashlights, batteries, first aid supplies, all of those things that you are going to need if you get stuck. Make sure the supplies last a couple days. If you're a visitor for a long time, like you're a snowbird, just secure outdoor furniture, decorations, and anything that could fly away or do damage to the windows or the house with high winds. Charge your devices. A lot of people don't think about this or turn them off until you really need them because you may need to try and get signal after a hurricane. I would really buy portable chargers and things like that if you are staying there long term. And then stay indoors during the storm. Once the hurricane arrives, please don't open your doors or windows just to get an Instagram video. It's not worth dying. Avoid flooded areas. Stay away from downed power lines. Use caution when you're venturing outside after the storm's passed. Be prepared for the aftermath. It's really sad and it's really hard. And a lot of people are locked in their house for a while because the flooding doesn't really go down for at least like 24 hours. Be careful trying to also drive your car through flooded areas and things like that.
Switching gears, let's talk about beaches. Everybody knows I love the beach. I'm a very tropical girl. Florida is also home to more sharks than anywhere in the world. Is it safe to go in the water, or are the sharks everywhere?
When it comes to swimming in the waters of Miami, it's generally safe as long as you follow the safety guidelines. South Florida, as you know, it's known for the shark population. The risk of encountering a shark, though, is pretty low. Most sharks aren't interested in humans as prey, and they typically avoid interactions. And also, lifeguards on beach patrols in Miami are pretty vigilant about monitoring the waters, and they provide warnings or closures if there's any dangerous marine life spotted. I know the purple flag is always marine life, so make sure you're checking those out. Be aware of potential hazards and take the precautions. There's a few I've got. Just swim in designated areas, stick to the beaches with the lifeguards on duty, and, you know, swim with marked swimming zones. Not just for sharks, but, you know, there's riptides and things like that as well. Avoid swimming alone. It's safer to swim with a buddy or in a group, especially in open water. Stay alert. Be mindful of your surroundings in the water and avoid areas with fishing activity where they're throwing a bunch of bait in and they got hooks, or schools of bait fish, because these also attract sharks. And then just respect the marine life. Avoid touching or approaching marine animals, including sharks, stingrays, jellyfish.
What's the best beach in Miami? Especially somebody like me, maybe I want to lay in the sun, do a little swimming. Where are the hot guys? That's what I really want to know. Where are the hottest guys at the beaches in Miami?
I would definitely recommend that you check out Miami Beach and you just hang out there. That's where all the hot, beautiful people are. They're having lunch. They're going shopping. They're wandering around on the beach. If you're going to get a drink or a spa and you want to know a good outdoor bar, the Clevelander, it's famous. It's right in South Beach. Good food, good action.
What if I want to take my husband and kids? What beach would I go to then?
I would definitely do a 180 and away from South Beach, and I would go to Key Biscayne. A bunch of families live in Key Biscayne. It's more relaxing. It's family-oriented. Great views. At night or after a big rain, there are pretty bad no-see-ums, those little bugs that bite you, and they hurt pretty bad. So I would go in the daytime.
I usually travel solo. A lot of people do these days. Is Miami fun and safe for a solo vacation?
This kind of depends on what you're trying to find and what you're trying to do. South Beach, it's popular for the vibrant nightlife. It's got a great amount of diverse shopping and dining options. You'll find so many cool people at bars, clubs, social events. However, it can get really crowded and it can get really rowdy. So just stay vigilant. Downtown Miami is really fun. It's a mix of entertainment and dining and cultural attractions too. It's also really close to Brickell and Wynwood for their night scenes. Brickell, super upscale on the river. It has high-rise condos. It's very sophisticated bars, restaurants. You got to dress a lot nicer if you go here. It's a popular spot for young professionals, and it's relatively safe. Wynwood, famous for its street art, hipster vibe. It's so cool. I really don't know if there's any place quite like Wynwood. Trendy bars, breweries, art galleries, and it's also a great place to meet fellow travelers and just really chill locals. Coconut Grove, if you're like doing families or you want a more relaxed atmosphere, it's got scenic parks, waterfront dining, boutique shops.
I really like weird landmarks, cool photo spots, obscure things, unusual cemeteries. What are some spots like that in Miami?
I have two favorites. My first one is the Vizcaya Museum and Gardens. This is a huge, totally bougie historic estate. It's got stunning gardens. It's European-inspired architecture, and it has really, really unique photo opportunities. I've been here with my girlfriends, and we all dressed up like Kentucky Derby style, and we had a great time. We just ran around, took pictures. It was really fun. Another place is the Versace Mansion. This is where world-renowned Italian fashion designer Gianni Versace was murdered on July 15th, 1997. He was shot outside his Miami Beach mansion by Andrew Cunanan, a serial killer who took his own life 8 days later. And this South Beach mansion is now a killer lunch spot. You can even stay there, which it's a little pricey to stay there, but I've been there multiple times to eat, and they have this great lunch special. He's got this like rainbow bedazzled mosaic kind of pool. They let you just wander around the house and take pictures and check it out. Coral Castle is really interesting. It's a mysterious structure that was built by a guy named Edward Leeskalkin. He used 1,100 tons of coral brick and secretly made it. So the construction is really a mystery. It wasn't this like obvious big project. One of Wynwood's staples is the Wynwood Walls. Outdoor museum showcases large-scale works by some of the world's best street artists. It's a really unique spot for colorful photos. Another thing I would say is the Venetian Pool. It's a historic public swimming pool that was built in the 1920s, and it has waterfalls, caves, just really incredible landscaping, and it provides a really picturesque setting for photos. The Kempong is a neat botanical garden. So if you really like greenery and botanicals, that's a fun place to go and just check out the tropical fruit trees and flowering plants. And then you've got the Oleta River State Park, which is Miami's largest urban park, and it's along the shores of Biscayne Bay. You can kayak, you can hike, you can picnic among the mangrove forests. Deering Estate is really neat. This historic landmark is an estate, and it has guided tours of the mansion and gardens, and then you can access the scenic trails along the waterfront. If you're a history buff and you're really interested in World War II, which I am, the Miami Beach Holocaust Memorial, it's just a moving tribute to the 6 million Jews who perished in the Holocaust, and it has sculptures and reflection pools. The Monastery of St. Bernard de Clairvaux, I may have butchered that, but it originally was built in Spain in the 12th century, and it was dismantled and reconstructed in Miami, which creates a really unique architectural exposition. Grapeland Water Park is fun. It's quirky. It's full of sculptures. I would say this is kind of fun to bring kids. It has a giant pineapple and like a shipwreck-themed play area. Miami City Cemetery, it dates back to the 19th century, and it's a cemetery that features historic gravesites, elaborate mausoleums, and it just has really neat, lush landscaping.
I'm definitely going to visit some of those places. What if you're in Miami and you want to do a day trip out of Miami? What are some places that you'd recommend?
Everglades National Park is a staple. It's a short drive from Miami. It's a unique ecosystem. It's full of wildlife. You can take an airboat ride to see alligators, birds, other wildlife, or you can explore the park's trails and visitor centers. It's also great if you're not from Florida and you're not used to seeing wildlife, and it's great for a family trip as well. Key West is always fun. It's about 3 to 4 hours from Miami, but it's worth the trip. It's got beautiful beaches, vibrant culture. You can visit Ernest Hemingway's home. You can explore Duval Street, and you can just relax by the water. You can also take a boat there or do boat rides there. Fort Lauderdale, it's only about 30 minutes from Miami. Beautiful beaches, shopping, dining, great cultural attractions. You can take a stroll along Fort Lauderdale Beach Promenade. You can visit the Bonnet House, which is actually really cool. And they also have a museum and gardens there. Or you can take a gondola ride along the city's canals, which is kind of fun and different. Biscayne National Park is beautiful. It's just south of Miami. It's perfect for the outdoor enthusiasts. You can go snorkeling, diving, explore the coral reefs, take a boat tour to see the historic lighthouse on Boca Chica Key, and enjoy spectacular views of the ocean. It's beautiful there. And I would say the last thing that's really cool in Wynwood is they have these garage parties. Well, they'll open up a garage, deck it out, put like drinks in there and like a photo, like, and you can just go in there with your friends, dress down and just have a really fun time, drink mimosas and party in these garages that have DJs. So that's really, really cool. Coral Gables would be the last recommendation day trip I would have. It's upscale. It's known for Mediterranean revival architecture, greenery. It has the Venetian pool that we talked about and also the Biltmore Hotel. So it's a little more bougie. And you can spend the day exploring the shops, restaurants along, they call it the Miracle Mile, or visit attractions like the Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden.
Those garage parties sound fun. Our victim today, Alicia Hannon, was staying at the Shore Club in South Beach, Miami. I know it's a really luxurious hotel. Have you been there? Can you tell me anything about it?
Yeah, I have not been there, but I have heard a lot about it. It's in the heart of South Beach, so Collins Avenue facing South Beach. It's known for the upscale amenities, very stylish, vibrant. The rooms are huge suites, luxury penthouses. The dining, they have the Shore Club Sky Bar and Lounge with incredible view of Miami. And then they have craft cocktails there, tapas, live music. Very chic, very trendy. It's on the beach, so it features a pool surrounded by tropical gardens, and then it's got bougie cabanas with the flat screen TVs and the mini bars and direct access to the beach, which is always nice. It's got a great fitness center, spa services, concierge assistance, valet parking, because every bougie hotel in Miami has great valet parking.
Alicia actually went missing in 2002. Was Miami a lot different in 2002?
Yeah, in 2002, I would say it was still vibrant and diverse like you see today. Miami has always just been a major tourist destination. South Beach mainly in 2002 was an epicenter for just like the party scene in Miami. It really was probably one of the biggest heights of like Miami culture. And everyone wanted to go to Miami and visit Miami and be like, I've been to Miami. You know, I had a party beach time. And then especially in the sports arena, if anybody knows, Miami has a really strong sports culture. It's got the Miami Heat, NBA, Miami Dolphins, NFL. And Florida Marlins, which is now Miami Marlins. And then in 2002, the Heat was particularly notable as they were in the heat of making their mark on the NBA. So just a really fun city.
Those are some great tips. And I definitely learned a lot about Miami that I didn't know. Thank you so much for all the great info. We're going to bring you back in a little bit to talk more about the case and also how to stay safe when you're in Miami.
Sure, sounds great. Thanks, Jamie.
Now, let's dive into the case of Alicia Hannon, missing from Miami, after a note from our sponsors. I'm obsessed with true crime, and I'm guessing you are too. So I'm always looking for awesome podcasts to listen to, and I have to tell you about one that I absolutely love. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, and I know that sometimes small town crimes can get overlooked in the media. And that's why I listen to True Crime Cast. Small town crime can include some of the most chilling and heinous murders that the world has ever unfortunately witnessed. And True Crime Cast is the podcast that covers these crimes. Jamie and John discuss a different crime or spree of crime each week. The crimes covered range from some of the most infamous cases to small town Appalachian murder mysteries that have flown under the radar until now. Jamie and John are great hosts. They're respectful, non-judgmental, and they dig deep to find all the clues. I consider myself an expert true crime podcast listener, so take it from me. True Crime Cast is a must listen, and I highly recommend checking them out. Listen to True Crime Cast wherever you get your podcasts. Proudly distributed by Stoveleg Media. Alicia Hannon was born in India on December 10, 1977, and most of her family called her by her middle name, Krishanji. She spent a lot of her childhood traveling as part of the Hare Krishna community. Hare Krishna refers to the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and is a religious organization that was founded in 1966 in New York City. They emphasize the importance of living a simple, spiritual lifestyle and mainly promote vegetarianism and nonviolence. The religion has grown into a global movement with temples, ashrams, and communities around the world. Her family eventually settled in New Zealand, a country known for its high quality of life, social welfare system, and commitment to environmental conservation. They have a relatively small population compared to its land area, which gives the people a reputation for spaciousness and having a laid-back lifestyle. Alicia had her son, Adrian, when she was in her early 20s, but sadly his father died when he was just 4 months old. Although that left Alicia alone to raise her son, her mom, Scylla Sank, took a front seat in helping to care for him. Alicia was always a sweet, smart girl, but after Adrian's father died, she got caught up in a bad crowd. In the early 2000s, her life began to spiral. While it may have started out innocently with partying, drugs, and money, she got sucked deeper into the nightlife as her drug use increased, and she started working as an escort. Being an escort, she flew all over the world on private jets with wealthy CEOs, being paid for whatever interactions they had with her. She was part of an elite group of women that was invited to party on Jeffrey Epstein's island, which I'm sure looked really glamorous from the outside, but as we know, those men prey on vulnerable people. And Alicia was in a very vulnerable spot in her life. While she was traveling and partying, her mom's house in New Zealand was home base. When she didn't bring her young son on trips with her, he'd stay in the safety of her mom's care. By 2002, Alicia was done with the lifestyle and was ready to make a major change. She had been traveling to Miami on a consistent basis to see a man she was dating, but he was a really bad guy. It took a little digging, but I got some information about Alicia's boyfriend. In my research, several news sources alluded to him but kept his name private, likely because Alicia's disappearance is an active investigation. So in this episode, we'll call him Mark. Mark was a civil rights lawyer living in Miami, and while I don't know much about their relationship, I do know that on July 19th of 2001, he was charged with 2 counts of misdemeanor battery against Alicia. There was also a charge of resisting arrest, but that was dropped. In the report, he was accused of dragging and pushing Alicia and her son, who was just 2 years old, out of their apartment. Mark entered a plea of not guilty and motioned for a jury trial. The discovery process began, and Alicia was issued a subpoena on September 19, 2001, but she never responded to it. And we know this happens with many abused women. So the case was discharged on September 24, 2001, and the file was destroyed. But unfortunately for Mark, things like that are never truly destroyed, and the information is available online under Florida State Case Number 13-2001-MM-042822-001-XX. And that was definitely not Mark's last run-in with the law, but we'll get to that in a minute. After that fight, Alicia went back to New Zealand with Adrian and told her mom she'd recently broken up with her partner. She said she was ready to leave her partying lifestyle behind and raise her son at home with her family. But she needed to go back to Florida one last time to tie up some loose ends and get some of her things. The last time Alicia's mom and son saw her was when she left New Zealand on a flight to the United States on her birthday, December 10th, 2001. Things didn't go well once Alicia got back to Miami, because she also went back to Mark. On January 1st, 2002, just 5 days before she went missing, Mark was again arrested, this time for one count of misdemeanor battery. Police were called to his home after he had an argument with Alicia, and according to the arrest affidavit provided to Stuff Media New Zealand by the Miami Beach Police Department, Alicia told responding officers that her boyfriend pushed her and knocked her to the floor. Once on the floor, he allegedly punched her in the mouth, causing bleeding from the gums and causing her bottom teeth to loosen. Records show that Mark was arrested and charged with battery over the incident, but was bailed out on $1,500. After that, Alicia apparently checked into the Shore Club, a luxury hotel in the 1900 block of Collins Avenue in South Miami Beach, Florida. On January 6th, at approximately 4 a.m., she left the hotel to get some food. And I don't know if she told someone that's where she was going or it was assumed, but regardless, that was the last confirmed time she was ever seen. Alicia never returned to the hotel and, by all accounts, simply vanished. Her passport, luggage, purse, identification, and credit cards were discovered inside her hotel room. And there has not been any activity on her bank accounts since her disappearance. Alicia was issued subpoenas to appear in court against Mark on January 10th and January 24th, but she was already missing and never responded. So Mark entered a plea of not guilty, and state case number 13-2002-MM-000078-0001-XX was discharged without conviction on March 20th, 2002. Zilla finally found out her daughter was missing when one of Alicia's friends in Miami called her and let her know they couldn't find her. Her mom made a missing persons report on January 27th, just a couple days after that second subpoena was issued. But the police didn't run out and look for Alicia, and they didn't put two and two together that she was allegedly in an abusive relationship. They also didn't put it together that right after her boyfriend was released on bail, she went missing. Instead, as soon as they heard Alicia had problems with drugs and worked as an escort, she went to the bottom of their pile. And this is nothing new. We've seen many women like Alicia be swept aside when they go missing just because of their lifestyle. It's important to remember that every single person deserves justice. And there are people out there that love and miss Alicia. Especially her mom, Scylla, who spoke to local law enforcement and a woman from Interpol, but soon realized nothing was being done to find her daughter. So she did what any parent would do, and many have to do. She hired a private investigator, and they traveled to Florida to find out what happened. When they arrived, police handed over Alicia's things. There was some jewelry and a jewelry case she knew was hers, but not her clothing. About the clothing, Scylla told the media, she liked nice things. This looked like what you'd find in a black rubbish bag at an op shop. She wouldn't wear those kinds of things. The police also gave her mom the $22 they found with her belongings at the hotel, but kept a hairbrush so they had a sample of Alicia's DNA. They didn't seem to be doing much more than that to find Alicia. But Scylla wasn't going to give up. She needed answers for herself and the little boy Alicia left behind. They tracked down Mark, who only spoke briefly with the private investigator before leaving the state. And since then, her family has not been able to find him again. But this was over 20 years ago, and with the internet being so much easier to navigate now, I was able to find him quite quickly. So the police should also be able to find him if they'd like to question him. Scylla and the private investigator spent 10 days in Miami, but they didn't find any clues and were no closer to finding out what happened to Alicia. The private investigator, ex-police detective Michael Campbell, said, "This was a tragic series of events which involved a beautiful young life, and there's no reason why this case couldn't be solved." Through the years, Miami police would occasionally reach out to Alicia's family to say that while the case was cold, it was still active. But was the case really active? On Alicia's official missing person report, Mark is written down as a suspect. So I have an idea who I'd look at if I worked in law enforcement. Speaking of suspects, Mark was eventually disbarred on November 7th, 2007, not for domestic abuse or murder, but instead he was convicted of 2 counts of grand theft. There was an emergency suspension on his license issued in Florida on March 1st, 2007. This meant the attorney's conduct had posed harm to the community or to clients, and the attorney is not allowed to practice law until they get the problem resolved. But the problem wasn't resolved, because after the review of his bank records by the branch auditor, it revealed clear, convincing, and undeniable evidence that he had misappropriated thousands of dollars of clients' funds, so they took his right to practice law away in Florida. Basically, he was using recent deposits from clients to satisfy obligations incurred in prior periods, similar to a Ponzi scheme. He was spending money that wasn't his. Then when he got a deposit check from somebody, he would use that to pay back the deposit from somebody else. Mark being disbarred doesn't mean he murdered Alicia, and it gets us no closer to finding out what happened to her, but it does show the type of person he is. Alicia was finally entered into NamUs on March 13, 2013, case number MP19635. Alicia's son, Adrian, is now 1 year older than Alicia was when she went missing. He grew up without his mom and deserves to know what happened to her. And because Adrian has been reaching out and asking more questions, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement shared a post about Alicia to their social media in early January 2024. Which was picked up by several news sources. According to the Miami Police Department, foul play is suspected to have played a role in Alicia's disappearance, and local police have since declared her presumed dead. Sadly, I agree with that presumption, and I also think her boyfriend had a role in her disappearance. I'm hoping that with renewed attention on her case, the police find the answers her family deserves. Sophia, after hearing about Alicia and this case, what do you think happened? Do you think it was the boyfriend, someone she knew, somebody else, maybe from her line of work as an escort?
This was a great episode, by the way. I totally think it was the boyfriend. And here's why. Her high line of work as an escort did put her in a lot of danger. I know that there's a lot of prostitutes that are like the prime targets for serial killers, criminals. But the authorities in Palm Beach, Florida, began building a case around Epstein in about 2005, and there were so many women involved. But those women, as horribly sexually abused, abused in general as they were, a lot of them lived to tell all those stories and help convict him and all the people that were in that, like, sex pyramid ring. So I don't believe they would have murdered her or been a primary suspect, any of Epstein's associates. However, she did provide her sexual services for a client that night, which I thought about, and that random client could have murdered her, because you see that all the time. But in regard to saying to her mom, she was done, she was just going back there to close things out, collect things, I find it hard to believe she did randomly do a last minute like sex transaction before flying home. And the timing is just, like you said, way too ironic with her boyfriend. They had that physical dispute. He got out of jail. And she disappeared. The last night she's supposed to be there, I imagine he knew she was leaving as well. And so I just think that it was probably the boyfriend. There could be other theories, but I'm going to go with he wasn't happy she was leaving him as his motive, and he just did her in. And he's clearly a violent guy.
I totally agree. But I always think it's the boyfriend, so I like that you're agreeing with my thoughts on that. For anyone planning to visit Miami, we want you to enjoy your trip and stay safe. Miami Beach has one of the highest crime rates in America compared to all communities of all sizes. Violent crime is more than double the U.S. average, and property crime is almost 3 times the average. The chance of becoming a victim of either violent or property crime in Miami Beach is 1 in 10. Knowing all that, Miami is an amazing place to visit, and I definitely recommend putting it on your travel list. Because Florida is home base for Sophia, she's got some more insider tips for your vacation. So, what are some areas of Miami or things to do that people should avoid when they're visiting?
Do not go to Overtown. It's historically known for its high crime rates. It's seen some revitalization efforts in recent years, but really, they weren't successful. It is not a safe area, especially at night. So again, that's part of knowing the neighborhoods, but that's one place to stay away. A lot of this is staying away from certain areas, but I'll get into a few other things as well. Liberty City is another neighborhood with a reputation for crime. Little Havana, we discussed Little Havana. It's got really cool Cuban vibes, but it is very sketchy in certain areas that just aren't safe, particularly at night. If you want to go, please just exercise caution. Go there in the day. Stick to a well-lit, populated area. Avoid certain beaches at night. While Miami's beaches are beautiful during the day, there's lots of people around. They can be very unsafe at night because there's no people and they're not well-lit. So just stick to well-populated beach areas and avoid isolated, poorly lit beach areas. Be cautious of scams and tourist traps. There's a lot of people that never think about this. Just be wary of overly aggressive street vendors trying to give free tours that require you to purchase a ticket at the end or scan your card or give them some sort of number on your card. And there's a lot of other schemes. So just be wary of that. I was walking down the street in Brickell in the broad daylight, and this guy came up to me and said he was just came from an Armani Emporium and had all these fake Armani watches. But a lot of people don't know what's fake and what's real, and tried to get me to buy one. I said, oh, sorry, I don't have any money. And I don't speak Italian. The guy spoke Italian and he was still trying to convince me. I didn't understand what he was saying. And I said, I don't speak Italian. And he said, oh, well, what? You can just take the watch. You know, let's just go to the ATM. And I was like, I'm not going to take you to the ATM. And he's like, oh, well, actually, we could just talk a little bit more about it. Like, my car's right here. Like, again, this is the little bit that I understood. He's like, look at the nice Range Rover. And I was like, I'm not getting in your car. I was really shocked because I was like, this is how this happens. There are people that are like, oh, yeah, I actually really want this. Or I want it as a gift for someone. Let me take you to the ATM. And they get robbed. Or they get in his car and they like never get out. So please be cautious of random people trying to sell you stuff, trying to have you sign up for things. Be careful when driving in rush hour traffic. If possible, just avoid it. Don't drive during that time of the day. Get somewhere, sit, wait, have another drink, hang out, Uber home after. Be careful when you're going out. Miami's nightlife scene, obviously, it's legendary. Some areas are more prone to rowdiness or crime. You know, there are some clubs that are a little bit sketchier. Exercise caution and be aware of surroundings, especially if you're out late. The last thing I'd say is public transportation. Miami does have public transportation options like buses. It has the Metro Rail. They're less frequent and safe at night. By less frequent, I mean they like stop running. And if you don't know that, you're stuck. Again, a story example. My friend Brooke came to visit me when I was living in Miami the very first summer. And we were taking the Metro Rail and we missed our stop and we went down past Freedom Tower. It is very sketchy down there. We had to get off because it just stopped. And there was also this guy tripping out on drugs trying to like hang out with her. And so we got off the train. There is nobody. We're in like the pitch black darkness. There's a bar we can see two blocks away, but it's the only thing in sight and it looks really sketchy. My phone had no signal. And so we saw a cop car sitting on the corner a block away. And I grabbed her and I was like, we're going to go to the cop car. We're going to knock on the window. And I'm like, hello, friendly citizen here, just lost and my phone doesn't work. She drove two blocks down with us until I could get signal to get an Uber. So again, the public transportation, don't take it at night. And I would even advise not taking it in the day. Ubers are better. And then the last thing I'll say about Ubers and taxis is those can be dangerous as well. Like, never get in an Uber without saying, who is this for? Don't say, is this for Sophia? Because they're going to be like, yeah, sure. And, you know, again, if you've had some stuff to drink, make sure it's a registered Uber or taxi. Don't just jump in a car. They'll see women or people just waiting on the street and they'll pull up and be like, your Uber's here, because they assume that you're on your phone. You're looking for an Uber.
What about the beach? Because one thing that I've always found as a problem, where do you put your stuff when you're in the water?
That's a tough one. Beaches like South Beach can have higher rates of theft, especially during peak tourist seasons when there are larger crowds. Don't leave valuables unattended. If you want to get in the water, or if you're not going to be at your towel the whole time, or if somebody in your group isn't, or you're solo traveling, I would use lockers. If they don't, I would really just stay right in the water where you can see your stuff. And I have done this in the past where I've asked if it looks like there's a little family sitting next to me or something or close. I'll be like, hey, can you guys watch my stuff? Like, I'm just going to go jump in the water. And most of the time they'll be like, yeah, sure. But again, that's taking a risk. You never know who you're asking to watch your stuff. I wouldn't bring any valuables to the beach at all. I also have a waterproof case for my phone that I can actually bring it in the water.
I always tell people when they travel, leave your jewelry, anything expensive at home, only carry the cash you need for that day. But Miami seems like I would want to go and show off all my expensive jewelry. Is it safe to walk around Miami with expensive things?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It can be a really fun place to show off and finally wear your fun, new, flashy things. However, in certain areas, it's not okay. And in certain areas, it is. Brickell, you can probably wear all your nice stuff. You'll probably be just fine. Again, staying along the main strip where there's all the clubs and restaurants. Anywhere else, I would say be extremely careful, especially since you're in a new city. If you have something that looks similar to kind of the vibe you're trying to do, I would do knockoff stuff when you're traveling, especially to these big cities, just like you do overseas to Europe or South America.
What about going to bars alone? Is that safe?
They can be, but I would avoid it if I could. So many female solo travelers get targeted in Miami, especially in bars and clubs, not only for theft, but they get drugged. There's a huge amount of sex trafficking that goes on in Miami. Don't take a drink from a stranger at a bar, especially if you can't see it being poured by the bartender. Men in Miami can be very aggressive. It's a little bit of the part of the Latin culture. And so you just have to be very upfront with them. And if they still don't leave you alone, walk to a bouncer. There's bouncers everywhere in those big clubs, and just say, hey, this guy won't leave me alone. And they'll tell him to leave you alone. And if he doesn't leave you alone, they'll most likely throw him out. Don't be afraid to do that. That's why they have security at these places.
What if I'm headed out for a night on the town? What am I going to wear? Because normally if I'm going somewhere warm, I only pack a bikini and that's just what I wear for the whole vacation. What would I wear out on the town?
This depends on where you're headed. I would say for Brickell or South Beach, ladies typically wear like a bodycon dress or a skirt and a top and then like nice shoes. They're big on heels there. I wouldn't wear sandals to the club or flats. I know they're going to hurt your feet, but it is possible to find comfy heels. And then a guy's button down, shorter long sleeve shirts. Some of them even wear suits. Again, that just depends because I know guys are usually like, I want to be casual, especially if they're not avid club goers all the time and they visit Miami. Some of the clubs have more strict dress codes and some of them have less strict dress codes. But again, guys, always nice shoes. If a girl were to wear a romper and like shorts and a crop and like sandals or sneakers, or a guy were to wear a t-shirt and jeans, that would be more like a Wynwood kind of style, going to a bar there, going to a garage party. And then if you go to a club, then I would dress fancier. The last thing I want to say about this is on the note of promoters, when you're going out in Miami on a night on the town and you're trying to get in with a promoter, again, if people don't know who promoters are, real quick, they will get women into clubs because they want to populate the clubs with women, with attractive ladies. And so to be able to get in a club and have free drinks all night and have a good time, it's a big money saver, but you also have to dress up nice and don't get your feelings hurt. You have to look the part to get in. It's a fun way to save money, and they do actually look out for you while you're in the club. I've always liked that as kind of having a friend there.
I'm all about true crime and watching crime on TV all day. I always see criminals dumping bodies in the swamps because the crocodiles take care of all the evidence. So does that really happen?
So many bodies have been found in swamps, but it's not necessarily a common method of disposing of evidence, nor is it a foolproof way to eliminate all traces of a crime. And I'll explain that. Some of that TV swamp dumping is creative liberty for entertainment purposes, but swamps do make it challenging for investigators to search thoroughly. With the water, the mud, the dense vegetation, discoveries can get super delayed. So that's why a lot of people are dumped in swamps. However, relying solely on like crocodiles or wildlife to dispose or eat the bodies is not really reliable. Crocodiles may consume some remains, but they typically leave behind evidence that can still be recovered and analyzed for forensic experts.
What would your number one tip to staying safe while vacationing in Miami be?
Don't trust strangers, especially if you're alone. Just be really aware of your surroundings. People following you on the street, a guy trying to buy you drinks that got his hands in his pockets, or if he follows you out of the club or the bar to the next place. I couldn't tell you how many times I've seen that and people just not really having common sense.
Amazing advice. I definitely go with stranger danger. Thanks so much for joining me on the episode. I really appreciate it and telling everybody about the ins and outs of Miami.
It was great to come on and just to share it. It's a beautiful, fun place. So don't let us scare you away just because there's your occasional horror story. Jamie, again, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. And I can't wait to hear more of the last trip.
Alicia Hannon walked out of the Shore Club in South Beach, Miami on January 6th, 2002, and was never seen again. Alicia was 24 years old when she went missing and would now be 46. She had long blonde hair, blue eyes, 5 feet 6 inches tall, and 120 to 130 pounds. She was wearing a gold ring with a yellow stone. Her ears are pierced and her left nostril is pierced too. She has a scar on the pad of her right index finger. Aliases she has used include Yami Sank, Krisanji Devi, and Krisanji Devi. Police have renewed their investigation, recently posting information about Alicia's disappearance on social media as part of their Missing Monday series in January. Let's help them and Alicia's family get justice. If you know anything about Alicia's disappearance, please call the Miami Beach Police Department at 305-673-7945. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.